Hello, this is World Business Report from the BBC World Service, where we bring you the latest in money, marketing, manufacturing, and yes, much, much more. Please review us, rate us, share us wherever you can. BBC podcasts are supported by advertising.
Wir bei Vertex wissen, dass die Geschwindigkeit des globalen Handels zunimmt, was eine Steuerverwaltung komplexer macht. Und ihre unternehmenseigenen Systeme sind nicht dafür ausgelegt, diese Steuerkomplexität zu bewältigen. Hier setzen wir mit unserer Plattform an, die Continuous Compliance ermöglicht. So erhalten Sie mehr Transparenz, mehr Genauigkeit und mehr Vertrauen in Ihre Steuerdaten. Sie wollen mehr über Continuous Compliance erfahren? Dann besuchen Sie vertexinc.com/de.
Hello, I'm Sumi Somaskandar from the Global Story Podcast. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump offer two very different views on climate change. One of them will lead the world's greatest producer of fossil fuels and have the power to reshape global climate action. So what would a Harris or Trump presidency mean for the climate crisis? The Global Story brings you fresh takes and smart perspectives from BBC journalists around the world. Find us wherever you get your podcasts.
And this is Andrew Peach with World Business Report from the BBC World Service. OpenAI is the company behind ChatGPT. But what's it worth? The answer could be $157 billion. We'll be live in Silicon Valley in a moment. Also today, as President Biden says he won't support an attack by Israel on Iran's nuclear sites, we'll look at the impact of the conflict on the Israeli economy. And we'll hear how car parts, syringes and fruit could fall victim to the port strike in the US.
Wilmington, Delaware is America's top banana port, and bananas are expected to vanish from stores in New York relatively quickly.
Don't forget, we love it when you get in touch with us, world.business@bbc.co.uk. Let's start with OpenAI, which has had a long-awaited funding round, making it one of the most valuable private companies in the world. The company behind ChatGPT has announced it's raised $6.6 billion, and now has a worth of $157 billion. Live to San Francisco and our tech reporter Lily Jamali, these are eye-watering numbers. And if they're true, it means the value of OpenAI has doubled in this period of this year since January.
Yeah, it's remarkable. And just to give you some comparables to that $157 billion valuation, the ride-hailing company Uber was valued at more than $80 billion when it went public in 2019, and that was considered a big deal. Airbnb was about $50 billion when it went public in 2020. These were in their day, some of the most hotly anticipated initial public offerings. So $157 billion, the new value of OpenAI, is not a number that I have come across in the decades since I started reporting on tech. It's almost, as you say, double what they were valued the last time they went out to seek funding. And I think this says a lot about where this company is at, the excitement around it, and what critics would call the hype surrounding the maker of ChatGPT.
The money's come from companies like SoftBank, NVIDIA, and Microsoft. Why do OpenAI need it? Are they burning through all the cash they've already got?
They are. I mean, you know, the computing needs alone are exorbitant. We talk about that in the context of energy, the amount of energy that's burned, but it costs a lot of money to secure the kind of technology to run that kind of compute. And it costs a lot to pay people to do this work as well. I was looking at their job listings today, and they have a lot of openings. They're looking for as much talent as they can right now. And they're throwing money at people to try to get them in as they go through a really interesting and important transition in the company's structure, going from a nonprofit research style organization to one that is really focused on the product and the selling of that product to consumers.
Sadly, I don't need any radio presenters. We'll come back to you in a second, Lily. Gary Marcus is the founder of Geometric AI, acquired by Uber, and the author of Taming Silicon Valley. Gary, good to have your company on World Business Report. What do you make of this valuation, $157 billion?
I think the most important word I just heard from Lily was hype. I don't think that the valuation makes a lot of sense. I can think of at least seven reasons to be concerned. There's a lack of profits. In fact, they're burning through money, as you just discussed, $5 billion a year. There's a lack of moat. So everybody else in the Valley is kind of trying to build the same product right now. Meta is basically giving away the same product for free. There's the unreliability of the software. It still makes lots of stupid errors like it did a few years ago. There's the hallucinations where they make things up, can't sanity check their own work. They still haven't shipped GPT-5. Everybody's kind of waiting for that, but it's been 2 years in the making, hasn't been shipped. They're not shipping Sora either, their video thing. Then there's the messy nonprofit situation you touched on. You know, it's not clear that they can turn into a for-profit or what that would look like, and they have to give back the money to the investors if they can't do that in 2 years. And then internal chaos. So Sam Altman is still there, but 20 employees have left in the last year, and a lot of them seem dissatisfied.
Now, you've always been critical of the company. I was watching the evidence you gave to the US Senate last year a little bit earlier. So that's not new, although it's a useful list of concerns that you have. Obviously, not everyone agrees with you, otherwise there wouldn't be this valuation.
No, of course not. It is interesting to look at the list of investors. So, for example, NVIDIA is giving them money to buy NVIDIA's own chips. So there's kind of like a circle going on. And so that's, you know, that's not an ordinary investment. Apple actually dropped out. Some other investors, I think, are interested in the energy consumption of these things as a possible customer for their energy. So, you know, different motivations for different companies. And of course, we have SoftBank, which famously put in money at WeWork at a $45 billion valuation that then fell. So, you know, that could be a kiss of death.
Your concerns about this company's contribution to this sector is that it's not regulated enough. You want more regulation. You want a chance to recall things depending on what happens once their products are out there. Obviously, AI brings untold benefits, but you're worried about the risks that come alongside that.
Well, the benefits haven't actually been told is the first thing we should realize. So, for example, a bunch of studies are coming in saying that the computer programming that they do is not making as big a difference as people thought. But on the risk side, in any case, we're already seeing lots of misinformation. We're seeing lots of non-consensual deepfake porn. We're seeing phishing scams. You know, we still don't have any answer whatsoever to how to keep these things safe and reliable and trustworthy. So there are a lot of risks.
Is it possible to do that? Is it possible to regulate something like this?
Sure. I mean, some regulation was just rejected, but the EU has regulation in place. I mean, you know, it's early days. It's going to take many iterations to get the regulation right, to get the right balance between innovation and protecting against risk. But certainly possible. In fact, Sam was standing beside me at the Senate last year, and at the time he was supportive. He's walked that support back.
Okay. And you're worried that, you know, chatbots powered by AI will have more influence on people's opinions around the world than social media does now. Those are the kind of concerns that you have.
Yeah, there was just a study, for example, that showed that these chatbots can implant false memories. So whoever has control of these, especially if there's no regulation, has a lot of control over what people believe.
Thank you very much indeed for being with us. That's Professor Gary Marcus. Back to Lily Jamali in San Francisco. Gary's got he argues the point well about the concerns he's got about AI and about OpenAI in particular. But the fact is that a lot of people don't agree.
That's right. I think there's a lot of excitement around AI. It's a controversial issue, and everyone seems to have an opinion. I was talking to an analyst today who said, you know, this valuation may look exorbitant by normal standards, but these aren't normal times. And this is not a normal startup. We don't know what the future holds, he told me. But unless AI is somehow a bust, which he says he can't imagine it being, OpenAI is going to be a powerful force to be reckoned with for the foreseeable future. And, you know, I think the fact that it's not just them, there's some very powerful rivals backed by very powerful entities in Silicon Valley and in the tech industry, that says a lot. You have Anthropic, which is backed largely by Amazon, XAI, which Elon Musk, that's his venture into this space. Obviously, he has pretty deep pockets. So there is competition, and I think that that's part of why we're seeing OpenAI really push into this very different direction than where their mission really began when Sam Altman and Elon Musk started the company in 2015, where it was really about sort of humanitarian AI for humanity, for the benefit of humanity. And now, well, they reiterate that mission in their statement today. I think it's really clear that the commercial aspect of this is really hard to ignore when you have the likes of Anthropic and XAI nipping at your heels.
Lily, thank you. That's Lily Jamali with us from San Francisco, live to Susan Smith now, who's portfolio manager at Exchange Capital Resources. What do you make of these numbers, $157 billion? Can any company be worth that?
Well, clearly they can be worth that because that's what investors are saying the value is. They're willing to pay this as they put the next round of funding in. But what I think it does show is the excitement that we've seen in the market this year over the potential for AI. And obviously OpenAI, ChatGPT, they've become part of this year's investors' vocabulary. And this seems to be the growth area of the future, certainly where investors are willing to take big bets and take these kinds of chances to try and get a great return.
What, if anything, stops it doubling in value again by Christmas?
Who can say? This is really one of the things where look at how much NVIDIA has seen their stock price rise since in the last 2 years. And the AI craze really only started in May of 23. So we're still very early on in discussing this, its potential, and investors have latched onto it as the real growth engine for the future and the potential in the market. So we don't know yet how high this could actually get.
Susan, stay with us. We'll talk a bit more later in the program. But first of all, if you're listening yesterday, I was in Asheville, North Carolina, talking about the effect of Hurricane Helene on businesses. Now, about an hour away from Asheville is the town of Spruce Pine. The damage the hurricane's done there could have big implications for the massive tech industry supply chain that relies on it, because the mines there produce a unique kind of high purity quartz used in semiconductors, the chips in almost all of our devices. And Spruce Pine is the only place on Earth where that high-quality mineral can be found in such big quantities. There are two companies that operate the mines there. They say they've had to close down the facilities because of the hurricane, at least for now. We'll talk to Peter Hanbury, partner at Bain & Co., with expertise in semiconductor manufacturing. I mean, that little list of facts is incredible to me. But basically, all the quartz that we need for our electronics comes from one place in North Carolina. Is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And this challenge certainly has the potential to have a large impact on the semiconductor industry if the shutdown of these facilities lasts for more than 6 months. The high purity quartz is a critical element in semi manufacturing, both to produce the silicon wafer itself, and it's used in wafer manufacturing tools used by TSMC and Intel and Micron. And then there's very limited suppliers or locations that meet the purity requirements of the industry. And then the complexity of the manufacturing process requires a single source with months of heavy engineering to qualify a new supplier or material. So it's very hard to switch. And so together, the combination of criticality and adding new suppliers means it's a potential to have a big impact.
Semiconductors are a huge business. Has this industry checked everywhere to make sure there aren't other places where the quartz can be found in the same volumes of the same quality?
Yeah, there's been a lot of work to understand where different sources could come from. The industry does understand and recognize these type of risks and spends a lot of time and resources identifying these risks, building mitigation plans, often high levels of inventory, and monitoring for these type of natural disasters, geopolitical challenges. And so the best players would have known probably about a week ago that there could be a challenge here. But the requirements of the process do require very high purity. Any particle or contaminant could destroy millions of dollars in wafers. And so they have to use the source they need, and they have some backup plans, but largely you count on inventory to cover you in a situation like this.
So many billions of dollars rests on this then.
Yeah. And honestly, it's not the only part of the supply chain like this. Because of the technical requirements and challenge of these manufacturing processes, you end up with many single sources of failure, either due to high R&D, benefits of scale, or in this case, a very rarefied commodity that can only be found in one place. So we've seen this situation before, like neon in the Ukraine at the start of the war. Gallium and germanium restrictions from China. Helium often comes up as a challenge for the industry. So it's a big challenge for the industry to manage these risks.
President Biden's been checking the damage in North Carolina in the past few hours. You'd think the bosses of the semiconductor industry would be getting themselves there and their people there as quickly as possible and spending whatever it takes to put the infrastructure back together so mining can continue.
Yeah, I think there'll be a lot of emphasis on how do we get these mines and infrastructure up as quickly as possible. The mine itself and the refining facilities associated will be the key pinch point to focus on. The road infrastructure, I think we'll find a way around, whether it's helicopters or other transport means. But getting that facility back up and running as quickly as possible will be critical so that we can fix the supply before we run out of inventory.
So if they can't, or if they can't fix it quickly and they can't find an alternative supply, what then happens? We can't make any phones.
It will get a lot tougher. I think, step one would be there are lower purity supplies of quartz that could potentially be refined. So I think many players will be looking at that. There is also the option of synthetic quartz, which could replace some functions. And the challenge will be these components will not work as well, and we'll see more yield challenges as we manufacture our chips. And so there'll be less chips available, likely.
Really interesting. Peter, thank you so much. That's Peter Hanbury, who's a partner at Bain & Co. with expertise in semiconductor manufacturing. We're going to have more a bit later in World Business Report about the impact of Hurricane Helene, because the building materials needed to fix the damage caused by the hurricane are caught up in the port strike in the US, more of which later on.
The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to World Business Report here on the BBC World Service. President Biden says Israel has the right to respond to yesterday's missile strikes by Iran, but that he doesn't support an attack on Iran's nuclear infrastructure. The US president said the Israelis needed to respond proportionately. Now, yesterday we talked about the impact of the conflict on the economies of Lebanon and Syria. Let's look now at the effect it's having on the economy in Israel with Joseph Zehra from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem, who started by telling me how Israel is funding its war effort.
Some of it came from American support that increased by $14 billion, which is around, it's almost half of the cost was covered by the U.S. Money. But part of it simply increases the deficit and the debt, which is possible to do for a limited period of time. And yet there is another effect of the war, which in my view, it's even more significant. And that is that this war, like all our previous wars against the Palestinians, it creates a recession in Israel. We are already in a recession. The data, at least on output and on investment, shows a significant decline since the last quarter of 2023.
And is that because business activity is suppressed by the conflict, because people don't want to or can't do business in that environment?
Not even foreigners. Even Israelis are afraid to invest money in such a case. Investment went down by something like 20%. Output, GDP, went down by 4%. And there is another reason for a high cost, which is the conscription, but that's a bit lower. That's 4% of GDP. Together, if you add together 26% of GDP and 4% of GDP, you get something close to 30% of GDP that could be avoided if we had some kind of peace process.
Let's just focus in on individual businesses, because presumably supply chains are disrupted. You know, if you're running, I don't know, a coffee shop or a restaurant, people in a city where there might be bombing aren't going to, you know, decide to go out for dinner with their family and friends in quite the same way as they might do normally. So there's all sorts of disruption at an individual level for businesses.
There are three main elements that are reducing aggregate demand significantly and cause a recession. One is the decline of tourism. The second is what you mentioned, that people go less out and therefore are buying less, and as a result, there is reduced demand. And the third and most important and most significant is that there are much less investment in the economy.
And the sense I'm very much getting from you is, okay, the Israeli economy can survive this for now, but what it can't survive is this going on endlessly. And of course, part of that is a decision of the Israeli government, isn't it?
You definitely pay a high price for the war, not only in direct cost, but also in reduction of output, in having a long recession, a severe recession, whether it will cause a long-time disaster, I don't know. What I'm saying in general, that the effect of having a severe recession is something that we already observe in the data since the last quarter of 2023. So we know that this is the story in that case.
And that was economist Joseph Zehra from the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. Now, still with me, Susan Schmidt, Portfolio Manager at Exchange Capital Resources. I want to ask you about EVs. Susan, we're always hearing about the incredibly tough competition from China in the electric vehicle market. So how come Tesla's gone up 6.4% in the 3 months to September? What's going on?
Well, Tesla certainly has been rewarded by investors in the stock market. But remember that the Tesla stock has seen a lot of volatility. And so we've seen that stock price move up and down by quite a bit in the past couple of years. They released their third quarter deliveries and production numbers today. And the deliveries number was actually pretty good and in line with expectations. Around 463,000 cars were delivered and 470,000 were produced. Those are good numbers for Tesla. There's concern always that Chinese competitors, particularly BYD, are moving into that EV market and taking share from Tesla, and Tesla is going to have a harder time competing given the efficiency and pricing of the Chinese models.
Did this happen because they did all the special offers and price cuts and deals and all of that, or did they not really need to do that?
I think Tesla's been very aware that they're coming under pressure. I think they view those price cuts as necessary. Certainly the consumer in the U.S. would say that they want to see a competitive marketplace and they need Tesla's pricing to be competitive for them to stay attractive in the market. We have other EV makers coming online now. Tesla is no longer the only brand prominent in the U.S. in the EV models. Interestingly, GM came out today talking about their EVs, but for them, that's only 5% of their cars overall. And while they saw great growth, 60% year over year, that's still only 32,000 units. So still a different scale.
Susan, thank you so much. Now, for the second day, 45,000 dock workers have halted operations at ports up and down the east coast of the US. So far, there is no sign at all of any agreement to end this action. My colleague Michelle Fleury has been talking to the president of the International Longshoremen Association, Harold Daggett.
I'm looking for $5 across the board for 6 years, and I'm going to fight for it because those greedy companies are making billions of dollars and they don't want to share. That's why we're out here now fighting for a contract, and we're going to win it, or this port will never open up again. From here to Houston, I'm not playing games here.
Do you worry that shipping rates are so high there's no incentive for
them? Let me tell you about the shipping rates. A container used to be $6,000. Guess what they get now? And right before the strike, they raised it up, the greedy They get $30,000 a container to ship to the United States. And they want to call us greedy? They make more goddamn money than anybody I know. It's about time they start putting tariffs on them and let them know they got to pay taxes to come in here. Not machines. Machines don't pay taxes. My people here pay taxes.
That's Harold Daggett with supporters all around him. Now, William George is Director of Research at the data aggregator Import Genius. I asked William, what products will be the first to start disappearing from shelves in shops?
Wilmington, Delaware is America's top banana port. And bananas are expected to vanish from stores in New York relatively quickly. There's this whole concept of just-in-time ripening, where the banana ripening process is controlled with refrigerated containers and timed so that it happens mostly in transit. And then the last bit of ripening will occur in stores and then when you brought the banana back to your house.
I guess for people in the US that have seen talk of the port strike on the news, they're not directly involved in it or have it on their own doorstep in their own town or city. But when you start going to the store and you can't buy a banana, it becomes a bit more real.
It does. And with the hurricane recently, Hurricane Helene, a lot of rebuilding is going to need to happen. And about 78% of U.S. plywood imports come through impacted ports. So I imagine it becomes very real if you're trying to get supplies to repair damage to a house or build a whole new property.
Yes, I was going to say, what else is on the list then of different products that are very quickly going to start to be in short supply? Once we've done with bananas, what's next?
Auto manufacturers, auto parts and full cars are pretty high up on the list here. Delaware imports the majority of cars into the U.S. And you can actually see right now vehicle carriers, which are stuck offshore in New York. There's one, the Aegean Highway, unloaded about 1,900 Toyota and Lexus vehicles on the 29th of September, and is now, that was in Jacksonville, Florida. It's now made its way up to New York, and it can't do anything further.
And if we're talking about vehicle parts for manufacture and all of that, this has an extra power at the moment because people involved in this sector are the swing voters in the swing states that will decide the U.S. election next month.
Yes, and General Motors, which has, you know, a classic history as far as U.S. auto companies goes, is one of the top impacted importers.
Are there any other products that we should be keeping an eye on in terms of supply and the consequences? I'm making a little list here. What else should be on it?
One thing that we've noticed is that the port of Norfolk is really critical for imports for Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk. And these include pharmaceuticals and also medical devices such as syringes and the needles required to administer insulin. These are just-in-time inventories as well. And Novo Nordisk has already announced that they are switching to air freight to keep disruptions from keeping people from, you know, receiving their necessary medicines.
So we've talked about bananas. We've talked about car spares. What else?
There's an interesting angle on this, which is that carriers actually stand to benefit potentially financially from this. Spot rates for cargo shipments are projected to go up 20 to 50%. And this is really remarkable because one of the complaints of the union is that their wages have not matched the profits that are being made by carriers. But this action, while being politically potentially devastating in the US, is likely to just continue to add to carriers' profits while passing on further costs to US consumers in terms of inflation and in terms of goods simply not being available and having charges increased for lack of access.
What happens in the end, do you think?
Well, the goal here, at least for me, is that they need to keep this under a week. A critical figure is that every day of strike results in snarls in shipping that can take 4 to 5 days to resolve. So if we see this get into a second week, even though, okay, the strike is over, sure. But in terms of companies having to deal with this, shippers having to deal with this, and impacts on consumers, that's going to go on potentially for months.
That was William George, Director of Research at the data aggregator Import Genius, with the latest on the port strike. There's more about all of today's business stories online, bbc.com/business. We were talking earlier about OpenAI and its mega valuation. There's a whole collection of AI articles there if you go online to bbc.com/business. From me, Andrew Peach, and the team here, thanks for being with us for World Business Report.
The Inquiry goes beyond the headlines, exploring the trends, forces and ideas shaping the world.
Politics.
Civil society.
Products and services.
AI.
Each week we ask one big question.
Can Germany's far right win the country?
And go in search of answers with the help of four expert witnesses.
Is Turkey getting more dangerous for women?
The Inquiry from the BBC World Service. Listen now wherever you get your BBC podcasts.